Hello and welcome to Conversations from the Adoption and Fostering podcast. In this episode, we speak to Vic, an adult transracial adoptee. She shares some of her story of growing up in rural England and the challenges she faced in a community that did not reflect her colour or heritage. Vic is open and honest in relation to her experiences and how they have impacted her into adulthood. She also shares some wider perspectives on adoption and adoptee support. We hope you find it enlightening, and as always, if you've experience of adoption, fostering or special guardianship from any perspective and would like to share that on the podcast, please get in touch through the Facebook or Twitter page or email us at andfpodcast@gmail.com.
Well, my name's Vic and I'm almost 50. Adopted. I was born in London, but adopted to a family who brought me back to Somerset when I was a week old. It was a closed adoption. However, I did come with some paperwork. So I was aware of what my birth name was. I was aware of what my birth mother's name was. A few of the circumstances around my birth, like my father was married already and he had a young son. And that was sort of all the information that I came with. And I was plonked down in Somerset as a, oh, I forgot to add, my father comes from Jamaica and my mother comes from Ireland, or came from Ireland, and plonked down in a very, very white town with a very, very white family and left to get on with it. I can't say it was always an issue for me that I just didn't like being different to everybody else. It was already enough that I was adopted. Having to then have different hair and different skin tone, and I couldn't have my hair the way the other girls were having their hair because my mother just didn't know what to do. So I just spent my whole childhood with short hair. As you get older, the hair products, I think even today, if you went into Boots in say Bridgewater or Taunton or Burnham or Highbridge or all the towns that are local to me and looked for anything for textured hair, you wouldn't find anything at all. There's not even a choice. Whereas you go into Boots on Oxford Street and there's racks of it, and I used to have my friend from London when I was serving in the army pick stuff up to me. And then I'd do the same when I flew back into the UK. My first stop would be Boots, and I'd get anti-frizz serum and things like that because just couldn't get them. And so that was always, it was a bit of an issue. I also have two sisters and a brother. So my whole backstory is that my parents were told they couldn't have children, which is a similar story to a lot of people, and immediately tried to adopt. They saw a program like Panorama or something like that in the late 60s that said all the biracial or mixed race, or as they used to call me, half-caste babies were left in the orphanage. So my mother decided that's what they would do. They would save a black baby from an orphanage. When they started going through this process, my mother was 19, and they got married at 18 and they started the adoption process immediately. So by the time that they had completed, they were turned down from my local authority because they were too young. So they went to an agency, which just took a little bit longer. But by the time they'd been approved for the agency, they had a phone call, and it basically gave them 24 hours to come and pick up a child. And that was it. They came and got me and went home. And within a year, my mother was pregnant with my sister. So she could have children. But another part of the story was when they were going through the process of adopting me, they'd been told that they would probably get a boy because little girls were wanted more than boys, and they had specified that they didn't care whether they had a boy or a girl. And it just so happened that the next baby up, which is one of the big adoption fallacies that we're told we're chosen, when actually we're not. We're just the very next baby up. And I was just the next baby up. So they had me, had my sister, and then decided that actually they wanted a boy. So they adopted again. And they had my brother. He was 3 months when he came, when they adopted him. And then they finally had my sister. So there's 6 years between all four of us. I'm half Jamaican and half Irish. My brother's half African and half Scottish. So we don't even look a set, you know, look similar. And both my sisters are blonde haired, blue eyed, long, like the sort of hair that I lusted after. So it was we always knew, like, we always knew we were adopted because you couldn't hide it. We grew up with racism within our family. Certainly my grandmother was terrible, and even microaggressions, things like if a black man came on television, she'd just start shouting at my brother and say how they looked alike. He looks just like you, doesn't he? And it's just like, it's just another black man on the television. He doesn't look anything like him. So that those sort of, you know, it just feels like little digs. You have that. Then you've got school, which was just horrible. Primary school was brilliant. I'm reasonably intelligent, so I did well at school. I could read before I started school. I got pushed up a year because my birthday's at the end of August, so my mum held me back. And as soon as I started school, they just pushed me up again anyway. And it was because it was a small school. That was fine. We were a community. At one point, all four of us were in the same school at the same time. And that was all fine. When I went to secondary school, it was horrific. I got punched in the head on my first day in school, and had the N-bomb dropped on me at the very same time. It was the first time I'd actually been assaulted like that. And I just didn't know what was going on because I was only just turned 11 as well because of when my birthday is. And then it turned out that actually I was the only child of colour in 900. So then I spent 5 years being a practice target for all the children that would later be racist adults. By the third year, which what's that in D789? By year nine, I pretty much stopped going to school. Because it just wasn't worth it. My mum and dad both worked, and so we lived very close to the school, so it was very easy to pop into school, get a tick, and then just go home. And I never got caught. I got caught once, I think, in 2 years. And I just didn't want to be there. The only thing that really saved me when I was growing up was sport. And I swam and I ran. And I did it a lot, sort of by the time I was about 11, 12, 13, I was swimming 6 or 7 times a week. And it just, that was the only thing that sort of saved my sanity, I think. By the time I was about 13, my parents could see that I wasn't happy and got me into therapy, which was a feat in the 80s. It's not as readily available as it, you know, as it is now. They had to actually do some work to get it, and really that was they put it, everything was put on the door of me being bullied. At no point did anybody acknowledge that any of how, what was going on, how I was behaving, because I was acting out. At the same time, my behavior was appalling, you know. If my mum told me that I couldn't go out, I'm out the window. You know, and it just, I was an absolutely awful teenager. I wouldn't have wanted to parent me as a teenager. A lot of the stuff was just, I didn't have an identity at all. I didn't know what I should be listening to, what I should be watching, what I should be reading, none of that. And I wasn't getting any validation from my teachers. My teachers could see what was happening and they weren't intervening. So that was making school impossible for me, which is a shame because I was good at school. You know, I could find that stuff easy. And it's just, yeah, completely unsupported. So that just tailed into, I left school. I was still 15 because my birthday's in August when I left school. And then I did a bit of a YTS and sort of worked at McDonald's for a bit. And then I went and joined the army, which I thought would be like looking for a family or just looking for someone that isn't white, something that's just not bloody Taunton, you know?
Yeah.
And so...
Can I ask a question about you? Because you sort of, you articulated really well this idea that people were looking at you saying, oh, she's getting a lot of bullying. So that's why she's, her behaviour's not great and she's struggling. And you sort of talked about identity, but was it kind of, were you thinking of it in terms of adoption or was it just identity and that sense of belonging and not sure where you sat?
I think when I was about 13, I had an existential crisis because I was brought up by atheists, but we were sent to the local church school and I can sing as well as other things. Well, I could when I can't now, but I could when I was a kid. And I was singing in the school choir and the vicar said, would I join the church choir? And my mum and dad were like, yeah, well, knock yourself out, you know. And they were supportive parents. They'd come and see me sing on Christmas Day or if there was, you know, even though it wasn't their blues, they supported it. So when I was about 11, I decided, yeah, I'm going full tilt for this Christian thing. Right. I'm going to get myself baptized and I'm going to be a full on Christian. And my mum and dad were like, fine, if that's what you believe, it's not up to us to, you know, and they completely ran with it. They gave me this big old christening party. And this, I was still in primary school or I'd just done, you know, I was sort of, yeah, I was 10. Coming to the end of primary school. So I was still like happy with life and God was good. And then I went into secondary school and had seven bells kicked out of me and was like, well, he isn't here now, is he? And then it all sort of, and all the adoption stuff, it all just came to a, and it was part of it was being adopted because I don't know who I look like. And it's not even, I don't know who I look like. I don't know anybody who looks like me.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, it's little things like when people adopt transracially, I've seen some great YouTube videos of mothers going to black hairdressers and learning how to do their children's hair so that they can support their children. That's brilliant. But I would say, actually, keep just using the black hairdresser. It's great that you can learn to manage and plait and things like that, but make it a thing. Every month we'll go to the hairdresser because one, it's with particularly with, well, with boys as well, it's a thing having your hair done. And if you're going to a salon where there are other black hairdressers, where you live in a community where, you know, from where I am, if you go to Bristol, then you're getting some of that mirroring in the very least. Do you know what I mean? It's just exactly, part of that. Actually, I can see myself in this person. And they're showing, you know, so it's great. Learn how to deal with all the different hairs and skin tones and all of that thing. But don't just bring it all home and keep it within the home. Keep visiting these places. Keep exposing your children to the culture that they'll be missing out on if they're growing up in a transracial adoption in places like Somerset.
Yeah.
But I took off to the army and... Yeah. It was the first time that I'd met other adoptees and it was the first time I'd met other transracial adoptees because far from being this sort of family that everybody says the army is, that's fine if you're white. If you're not white, in the 90s, it was still racist and it was, you found yourself seeking out, see, I get upset talking about this, but you find yourself seeking out the other black people in your base because you have to. There's not safety in numbers, but you just want to know who your community is because if something happens, then you know who you can go to just let off steam they will know how you're feeling. Hmm. And then it just turned out that these two guys are transracial adoptees that had pretty similar experiences to me, one being brought up in Yorkshire and one being brought up in the Northwest. Which was
that's quite a startling coincidence, isn't it? It's, you know, the chances of that in any other community was pretty slim.
Yeah. And that's another one that I, you know, that's a study out there, isn't it? How many adoptees are actually in the armed forces? I've spoken about it before, like on Twitter, because it is, you know, I've spoken to quite a few adoptees who've served, and some that are still serving. So, you know, there is maybe this looking for self or looking for an identity that
belong.
In the army, you don't have to have an identity. You're just another green person. So you although because if you're black, you're just a black face in a sea of white, green, white and green. So you immediately stand out. But it got me over to Germany, which got me to see other cultures. And do you know the big thing that it did for me outside of my race was because the other thing about Taunton and Somerset is not just black people. They don't like gay people either. And I really hadn't been exposed. I had my own prejudices, if I'm honest, going in, but I'm not that close-minded that I can't change my mind.
Yeah.
Really quickly when I realized that I'm really, really wrong. And I found that out really quickly in the army, and I found so many allies and so many good friends from just every walk of life. And it just didn't matter. And it made me realize that they were taking me in my little clique of friends, because we were sort of an anti-clique of gay people and sort of straight people who didn't really fit in with the other straight people, sort of. We just sort of went off to ourselves. And it was the first time that I was just accepted for who I was rather than what I was. Like I was a member of a swimming team or an athletics team or, you know, it was the first time that it was just, yeah, we were just free to be who we wanted to be. And Everybody was accepting of everybody else. And so that was the only part of the army that I would take with me as being positive. It wasn't the right place for me at all. It wasn't, I'm just not cut out to be told what to do, really. On that sort of level, I just kept getting into trouble. I think, again, it is the adoptee in me, although I didn't know it, that you're people-pleasing. So you're always people pleasing. So you're always the life of the party. You're always the one that's having a laugh and getting into trouble and just, you know, attention on me. Look at me, aren't I? It's just hot. I'm happy to say I'm not the same person now, but at the time, I didn't realize there was a lot of stuff going on in my head that I wasn't acknowledging.
Yeah.
It was the first time that I was diagnosed as being a depressive, and it's the first time that I attempted suicide. And then I went to a military hospital for a bit and came out, and it really, I wasn't going to heal in the army because they're just not interested in mental illness at all. So we came to an agreement, and I wasn't medically discharged, but I did get out. And then I came home, and I think within about 4 months, I had a complete nervous breakdown. And I got hospitalized, and that wasn't very much fun at all. And all of this time, through all of this, not one person, not one therapist, not one doctor, not one psychiatrist talked to me about adoption. Not a single one of them.
I mean, it seems like it's hidden in plain sight, like with hindsight now. It's
absolutely, but I would have said that I was a fogged adoptee still then. I just was, I don't know, there's part of me that is not happy that I had a breakdown, but it almost needed to be done to reset. Because it actually gave me the headspace to just rationalize a few things and get things straight in my head. And I went from there to volunteering at the Big Issue. Because my headset being, if I'm working with the homeless, then that's going to give me an everyday reminder that at the end of this, I go home to a warm flat and food. And, you know, my parents would have been that safety net that, that if I ever got into trouble, I know that there's someone that's got my back. And these people don't have it. They come in at the beginning of the day with no money whatsoever, a plastic bag. We would lay them on two Big Issues. They would go and sell those, pay us back, and then buy two more, and then spend the rest of the day just working it up. And then they'd get to £10 and go off and score. And then we'd see them again in a couple of hours. And it was interesting from the point of view that it did help me acknowledge that actually my life isn't completely shit. And that I've got value because I was, they remembered, I've met people since and they remember me from working there. But it was also an interesting exercise in the people that we saw at the Big Issue came from three user groups. They were either prison users, they were either ex-forces, or they were either from the care system. And pretty much they are the three user groups that we saw. And it's a sad indictment on all three of those institutions that we saw the amount of clients that we saw from those backgrounds. Because, you know, none of those three institutions prepare people for living on the outside. And they fall through the cracks. And it is scary. Mental health hospital as well. We saw quite a large proportion of people that were dual diagnosis. So drugs and alcohol wouldn't see them because they were mental health and mental health wouldn't. So it gave me a grasp on actually, you know, maybe my life isn't that bad. And I met my ex-partner and then I had my daughter. And that was life-changing from the point of view that I had never, ever touched anybody that I was biologically related to ever in my life. I'd got to 28 and I had never, ever touched anybody that shared any DNA with me. And I had got my records from social services about 3 or 4 years earlier and just done nothing with them because I knew what my mother's name was. And I put it into the internet a few times and it just hadn't come up at anything. And I'd done the same on the records that I'd had from social services. My father's name was on there and I'd put that into Google a few times and got nothing. So I'd sort of given up. And then there was a site that came up called Genes Reunited or something. So I just put my birth mother's name into that. And I think Molly would have been about one or two then. And it came up with a family tree of my birth mother on it. So, I will say before that when my daughter was 7 days old, I almost had another breakdown because I just couldn't believe, because I was 7 days old when I was adopted, I just felt for my mum, my birth mother. I just thought she was 18 years old. And the stuff that I had said, you know, she would grieve for her baby and things. So she must have just been breaking her heart and I was breaking my heart for her. But anyway, move forward. And So I reached out to the person that was managing the tree and she said, well, can I ring you? So she rang me up. And the first thing she said was, I'm really sorry, your mother passed away in 1992, which was about 10 years ago before, you know, it was about 2002. Yeah. But she was one of nine. And that you're not like a secret or anything. They always wondered what would happen to you. Are you okay with me giving you their contact details? So I was, yeah, that's fine. It was really sad. you know, because but I didn't know the circumstances at that point. And part of me was like, well, this good job that I've found them, because if it was a female, you know, like breast cancer or something yeah. like that, then that's something that I need to know. And so I made arrangements to go up to London to meet some of her sisters. And it was a really weird one, because they didn't make sense to me as a family. I couldn't see myself in any of them. They didn't operate like a family that I knew, if you see what I mean. The first person I met was one of a set of twins, one of my aunts. And her twin, they didn't speak to each other. So when she came to pick me up, the other twin, because I didn't know where I was going, so I've gone to meet one twin and had tea with her. Then I was going to see the other one with another sister and spend the night there. And she was sat outside in her car. And I was like, well, this is bizarre. Because even if we fall out in our family, we don't fall out like that. There's no, like, no, I won't talk to them, they won't talk to me bullshit. So I was like, oh, this is weird. I'm not sure about this. And then it seemed like we were the new toy that everybody wanted to play with. And there was just this procession of cousins that I didn't look like and didn't mean anything to me. It just was a bit of an anticlimax. And it was just like the only person that I was interested in meeting had already passed away. And the other people, I didn't feel bonded to them at all. I still don't. But then I found out some other stuff, because one of the first aunt, when I met her and she said, your mother, she never got over giving you up. When she was on her deathbed, she was calling out for you, and we had to tell the nurses who you are. Now, I think that's a lot to lay on someone for your first meeting. And I carried the guilt of that for a little bit. I'll be honest with you, because I just thought, all right, so it's my fault then, is it? And it frittered out, because I wasn't really interested. I every time I approached them for medical information, I just didn't seem to get very far. So I just sort of gave up on them and gave up on the whole reunion thing as being just a bit, you know, a waste of time. And then I'd always had this thing, because it said on my adoption papers that my father was married with a young son. And I was like, so I have a big brother out there and I'm the eldest in my family. And there were times when I was getting bullied that I'd in my head, I'd be like, if my big brother was here now, he would come and he would pound you, you know? And you like in your head, if my brother was here now, you live this little. So it didn't, it just niggled and niggled and niggled. And then I had Fred, and I just sort of cracked on with life, and I moved out of town. Unfortunately, the victim of a couple of racial attacks in Taunton, which I prosecuted, because I got to the point when I was racially abused with my daughter with me, and she was three, that I was like, no, do you know what? I'm just not putting up with this anymore. I've had it all my life, and I don't want my daughter to hear people speak to me like that. I didn't want my children growing up there. The guy I worked with at the Big Issue lives in a little village, and lives in social housing, and he said the house next door to him had come available. So I got my housing association to move me out to the middle of nowhere, and I like it out here. People leave you alone. I won't say it's not racist, but it's much more covert, if that makes it. It's you're not judged by the color of your skin out here. I like this little village. They take people on face value, which is a rare thing. And they, you know, there's some really solid people here, and they leave you alone if you want to be left alone. So that suits me. I do get involved. Obviously, I'm an ex-service person, so I get involved with British Legion stuff. And when the children were in school, PTA and toddler groups and all that nonsense. But I'm enjoying being a little bit more out of it now that they're older. And then I came to take a DNA test. And I wasn't thinking much of it. And I got a really high hit for a female. And in my head, I'm like, no, that's wrong. I've got a brother, not a sister. That's totally wrong. And there were a couple of first cousins down there. And the one benefit of being biracial is that on these DNA sites, you get your ethnicity. And so I can sieve out the Irish half of my family very quickly.
Yeah.
To focus on who I was looking for. So I contacted a couple of first cousins, and they didn't know who my top hit was either. So in the end, I just sort of thought, I wrote to her. Oh, I didn't write to her. I messaged her through Ancestry and said, I think I'm your sister. And she messaged me back, and it turns out we are half sisters. Our father, she was brought up by her biological mother.
Right.
But our father left her like he left my mother. And then the first cousins were like, well, you've got two brothers out there. And they're full brothers. And so they reached out to them, and they, you know, within about 24 hours, my WhatsApp was going nuts. It was going off every 30 seconds. And it was like me talking to one brother, then talking to my sister, then talking to a cousin. And not a single person turned their back. Everybody was really opening. And yeah. And then it turned out that my birth father was still alive, which I had very, very mixed feelings about.
Yeah.
Because I think part of me that had held back had thought, well, if I leave it long enough, then he'll probably have passed away, and then I won't have to deal with that. Because, like, it's probably something that your adopters will want to hear, but nobody's going to replace my mum and dad. And, you know, certainly not somebody that walked out on my mother 50 years ago, and then it turns out did it to two other women, you know, not someone like that. He's never going to replace my dad. So I think my mum and dad were a little bit worried until I told them, I can't, no worries. The man's in Jamaica. Just honestly. So, and I didn't even want to ring him. You know, they were like, I had the options, and I'm like, no, I don't want to ring him. I'll write to him. Yeah. So I wrote to him, and he didn't write back. And then I got so, because his sister lived, he lived near his sister in Jamaica, some sort of, he might not have got it. So I wrote a Christmas card to her for her to give him. But then he got really quite poorly. And that was just before that would have been just before lockdown. One of my biological cousins is a barrister. She was getting her silk. She was being made a QC, and so her my aunt, my father's sister, was coming back from Jamaica to see her daughter go to Old Bailey and have all the, you know, with the wig and all of that. And she wanted to meet me and my sister, because nobody had ever met a sister. So we went up to London to meet her, and I look exactly like my paternal grandmother. So as soon as she saw me, she just said, yeah, you look, yeah, there's no denying it. And I think a lot of their culture, DNA doesn't mean anything. It's what they see. And so that, like, but one of the first things she said to me and my sister was that he knew about my sister, but he didn't know about me. And right. That's what he told her. But I know that to be a lie, because my adoption paperwork, I had my social worker's report in front of me, and it said that he told my birth mother that he'd stay with us if she could find a flat, and he'd make, that's it, a week offer to rejoin her, it says in the paperwork. And she realized that she couldn't find a flat, and really he just wanted somewhere to come at the weekend. So he absolutely knew about me.
Does that put you in an awful position where you're the bringer of, you're having to cast shade on someone else? Right.
I didn't cast shade on her, but I just didn't see, the point there. She's an old lady. It's her brother. It's just not worth making. My sister knew, And my brothers knew, and they were the important ones to me. And yeah. all of them knew, and none of us said, we all knew. As soon as she went, we all knew. And we spoke about it, and they all knew. Do you know what I mean? So to me, it was more important that, you know, that my brothers and sisters knew, because they knew what sort of man he was, than anything else.
There's just no route map for this, is there?
No.
In the sense that...
And
it's so out of anyone's norm. You are just this, like, a sense of you having to navigate this alone.
Yeah, and I think that's what people don't... that's what makes reunions so difficult, that you're having to navigate family politics that are entrenched and have been there for eons before you arrived. And when I approached my birther's family, did I choose the right aunt? If I'd chosen another aunt, would I have found that actually when I'd asked for medical information, it would have been forthcoming? But I chose the do you understand? Yeah. Because I don't know what the family politics are. So I just went with whoever reached out to me.
Yeah.
And then realized that there was loads of stuff going on in there that I had no idea about. As I was being adopted out, my mother's sister was adopting in, but she was adopting in a white child, and my mother wasn't allowed to keep me because I was biracial, and she had to go back after having me and live with this sister who was adopting in.
That's just... through the lens of it's just impossible to make sense of that, isn't it? How people reconcile all of that.
And I can't reconcile, not myself, because having met them, maybe I was better off out of that side. But what they did to my mother, I don't think I can forgive them for.
Can I ask as well, because I'm conscious, you know, your maternal biological family that is kind of, that's complicated. There's a whole different set of complicated with your paternal biology. But in the midst of all that, and from what I've seen, what I know of you and what, you know, conversations, is that you've got a love and respect for your adoptive family as well. So are you trying to keep all that? You know, are you trying to manage that as well?
You have no idea how many balls I'm juggling. I'm more conscious of my mum and dad. If I put it into, like, if I had to rank it on, you know, my mum and dad come that are first. Yeah, because I do love them. So, you know, what do you want me to do? I can't be an angry adoptee. I'm an angry adoptee, but not because of anything that my folks have done to me. I'm angry at the situation I found myself in, but not anything that I don't think they did anything wrong. And then my biological siblings. And then after that, well, no, actually, let's start again. I forgot my children.
Awkward. Yeah, we'll fix that in the mix, shall we?
Well, that's a given. Right, kids are a given.
It's a given.
Okay, my kids are that's a given. Then my mum and dad, then my biological brothers and sisters, and then my adoptive brothers and sisters, because I have to acknowledge that we have nothing in common at all. And that the only thing that we have in common is the 18 years that we shared a house. There's not really very much else. Personality-wise, I'm not like them at all. My biological brothers and sisters, it's just something I can't put my finger on it, and I don't know what it is, but I can spend 2 hours on the phone with my brother Jason. I can spend, you know, an hour and a half on the phone with my sister and talk about nothing, you know. And it isn't just we're getting to know each other, and that we've done that now, you know. I've been up there a few times, they've been down here, we've spent hours and hours and hours on the phone, we've got a pretty good gauge of who we are. So now it's just we talk about nonsense, and I really like it.
I mean, I'm no expert, but is it maybe that siblings don't expect very much of each other, whereas parents and children, there's all those peculiar dynamics about duty and responsibility and where you fit in, whereas siblings is not that. Do you think maybe is that?
I think within the terms of adoption, the most, if you can't maintain a link to parents, and I do appreciate that there are some parents out there who just aren't able to parent. I do know that. I am a realist. But maintaining those links to siblings, if siblings have, and I know quite a few young people, young adoptees, and they've all been kept together in sibling sets. And I think that's important, because at the end of the day, it's almost like, if nobody else matters, I've got you. And you have got that genetic mirroring. You do look like somebody. You do have this like thing going on that's almost invisible. And if I could say one thing to adopters, if you have the ability to make sure that your children, if they have siblings, get contact with them as soon as you can, because it's never too young. Even, you know, we've learned from the pandemic that you don't have to be next door to somebody to be able to maintain a contact. Even if you can't have a physical contact, you can do it via FaceTime, via Zoom, you know. And these things are important, because knowing I had a brother out there and actually meeting him was just, it just blew my mind. And it was like the fog of adoption just, I was so angry. I was like, how can you take these people out of my life for 50 years? So my sister grew up 40 miles down the road from me. It's 40 miles away. We were apart for 50 years, and we probably went to the same places shopping. We probably went to the same gigs. There's only a couple of years between us. And yet we didn't even know that we were related. And that's just cruel.
Yeah,
you know, I think anyway that it's cruel. And
can I ask you a bit more? I mean, that, you know, you've given a really, you've raised more questions than you answered, which I think is exactly, you know, what I always want from conversations. I want to go away having, you know, you've stirred up a lot of things for people to think about. But right at the moment, I know that you kind of work is maybe the wrong word, but you support into the adopted adult community, don't you? And you're bringing people together. So what's your aspirations, and, you know, what are you doing with that? Why are you doing that?
It really started off a little bit selfishly. I'm in a couple of adoptee only Facebook groups. Somebody started off as a Zoom chat because of the pandemic. But this adoptee-only Zoom chat was based in the US. So an evening chat for them at 8 o'clock, I'm having to stay up till midnight. But I was finding that I was doing it because I just hadn't met more than two or three adult adoptees face-to-face ever. So actually being in this, say, virtual room with a lot of other adoptees who were saying the same things as me was mind-blowing. But I just can't maintain staying up till midnight every time I want a chat. So I just thought, well, I'll have a go with adoptee Twitter and see if there's any, because I followed quite a few UK adoptees, and see if any of those fancy getting together via Zoom at a more UK friendly time. And it just sort of went from there. We're not super busy. We tend to only have maybe 8-10 adoptees join us at each chat, but that's good. Because it means that people can come in and they have the space to talk. If there's too many people, I'll break it down into smaller rooms, because it's important that everybody gets a chance to hear their voice, to have their voice heard. And also sometimes you'll find that someone comes to the chat, because there's some people that come regularly, some people just are intermittent, and I've always said it's dip in, dip out. If you, sometimes you'll find you just need to chat, then come on. So some people will come in and there'll be a piece of news that they really want to share. And it's making sure that everybody gets a chance to do that. And then in the new year, we decided that we were getting a little bit tired of each other's voices, and maybe to expand the group and get us thinking a little bit more, we'd invite some speakers in. And so since then, we've been really very lucky. We've had a couple of authors and some search angels who are helping. A lot's come out of that because they've been able to link up with a couple of our adoptees. And it's just having that community. It's being able to go in and just say, it's my birthday in a week, and have the whole room and not have to say anything else other than that.
Yeah.
You know, Mother's Day is a big thing. Mother's Day, just, I hate it. And Chris, all these big occasions, because it's being thrown in your face that you're not with your family. That's, you know, I know a lot of adoptees that don't get on with birthdays, don't get on with Christmas, don't get on with Mother's Day. I'm one of those. My children are now down with that. Now they're older. When they were children, then we went the full nine yards, glitter, you know, exploded in the front room, and trees and presents and snowy footprints and all the stuff that you should do. I'm a big believer in children having imagination and keeping that going for as long as you can. But as soon as they were old enough for us to be realistic about it, as soon as they started asking for money rather than presents and things like that, I'm like, well, do we have to put up decorations? And they're like, well, I'm like, well, if we want to put up decorations, you put them up. And it's like, no, we won't bother them. Do you want turkey for Christmas dinner? Do we have to? I don't really like turkey. No, we won't bother then. Pre-lockdown, I was hoping to get up to London for Christmas and just go and do, because of my homelessness background, just go and do the week crisis at Christmas, just volunteering, because you can go up there for a week. And just they open it all up for the whole of the holiday week, and you can help you can do a load of good work without even having to focus on the fact it's Christmas. The rest of the world can go on, but then we had lockdown, so maybe not. So, I forgot where I was getting
them. No, you were just sort of talking about really how you know.
Oh yeah, no.
You
so
can
that,
share
and that's,
stuff.
Yeah, and I am. I have very very few rules. The like the normal self, you know, respect thing, no bullying, no hate speech, and keep everything that you hear confidential. I don't record anything, not a single second of it, because I want people to feel as safe as they can to share their stories. And a bit like you were saying at the beginning, if it looks like someone's going to open up, then I just try and pre-warn them that we're not therapists. So if you're going to do this, be aware, you know, going in. I knew coming in today, you know that quite often when you tell your story, you're going to trigger yourself. If you're doing that with a therapist, they're equipped to close you down. If you're doing that within a group of friends, they're not. It's just making people aware with what they share and how, you know, how willing are you for the flip side of that. Most of the time people find it beneficial once they've shared, because I know I've got my camera off, but a lot of the time when you're speaking, I'll nod. And when you're doing that in the chat and someone will say something and then you look out and you see 10 heads all nodding at the same time, agreeing with what something that someone's just said, it can be very validating.
Yeah.
It really can be.
So, I mean, people will, when they listen to this, they'll be able to link to your Twitter bio, and then if that's something that is appropriate for them, then are you open to new people joining?
Yeah. I mean, we generally try and avoid, and I know not everybody, but we tend to find that anybody that's another part of the triad, it doesn't go down so well.
Yeah.
So we've had a birth mum who's also an adoptee, and that didn't work out so well. So, I'm a little bit wary. I do ask people first because, it changes the dynamics and it changes how people, how willing they are to be open if they know there's an adoptive parent within the group.
Yeah. I mean, I totally get that it's got to be a safe place for people, hasn't it? Otherwise it defeats the whole object.
But it has, you know, we've made some good links. And there's, I get a bit motherly about some of our younger adoptees. But, you know, they're, because there's so little out there for adoptees. So we see a young adoptee who's upset and in trouble in this country. Who do they go to talk to? I mean, honestly, who do they go to talk to? PAC UK work in what? Yorkshire and London? If you go to your GP and say, I'm having a crisis and it's got to do with adoption, the GP, you can only go to Ofsted registered therapists if you want to talk about adoption. So even if I want to pay a therapist out of my own pocket to deal with my acknowledged adoption trauma, unless they're Ofsted registered, they can't treat me. And they could get prosecuted if they did. And I think that needs to change, because I'm 50 years old and I have to go to my local authority to get counselling for something they did to me. That is ridiculous. I can't even put my hand in my pocket and pay someone myself. Go on.
No, I was going to say, you can understand the logic in that, but the actual outworking is madness. You know, you want assurance that people who you go to for help can help you and are qualified. Mm-hmm. But actually, the practical reality of that is that people are so few and far between. And I was reading on Twitter last night when, you know, people were saying, but what if people are not aware that that's the underlying issue, that they find themselves, you know, they maybe go for mental ill health. Halfway through, it becomes apparent it's the root or part of that picture is adoption. Then what do they do? Because they've set themselves on a course that they need to then, by law, should stop. Because they've not picked the right therapist at the beginning because they didn't know. It's madness, isn't it?
Well, and I think it's a bit of a fraud, because I went to talking therapies and I was given a therapist, and I went in saying, you know, these things happened and I want to talk about, you know, being adopted and that. And she kept sidestepping that and saying, no, let's talk about your bullying and things like that. And I was getting quite angry, because it was like, that's not what I want to talk about. So I ended it and wrote a letter and then gave her the link to the Paul Sunderland YouTube video and said, I really think you need to watch this, because to not acknowledge it. And then she was saying things like, because I just found my birth father. And I was saying, well, I'm being pushed quite hard to go to Jamaica and see him. And she was like, oh, I don't think you should go to Jamaica. But not giving me any basis for why she was saying that. And so I was like, oh, no, that is, we're wasting each other's time.
Yeah.
And then I went back and said, no, that's not working. And the next person that they sent me a CBT workbook, which I sent back and said, no, forget it, leave it, I'm not interested, it's not what I want, you're not. And then they sent me back a leaflet for PAC UK, who don't do anything in Somerset. So, you know.
Just an absolute wasteland, isn't it? I'm conscious that I've used up a whole hour of your time. Is there anything that you'd hoped I was going to ask you that I haven't asked you, because you wanted to say something? Or is there any points you wanted to get across that you've not had the opportunity to?
No, I mean, I think if anybody looks me up on Twitter, if you read my pinned tweet, you'll pretty much get where I'm coming from. I think my the only thing that I'm really digging my heels in at the moment, I'm really disliking, is international adoption. Think it's wrong to remove a child from their country of origin for whatever ends. And so that's the only thing I want to finish with. If you're thinking of adopting internationally, please don't. At least have a look domestically. You're not getting the clean slate you think you are. Everybody thinks of a newborn baby as a clean slate, but we've lived with someone else for 9 months. We come with trauma.
I think I agree that there is no such thing as a clean slate. We're not computers that you can wipe hard drives off, are we? Children
and no, and it is, you think about what, like, I was with when I had my children, I had, I'll do this and then I'll finish, I have birth books for them, so, you know, it's like when I was pregnant, pictures of their scans, what I liked to eat, the names of the midwives, what I was listening to, all of this stuff in little books with pictures and things, and then you carry it on for the first year. Well, adoptees, we arrive without any of that stuff, without any of that past 9 months. We arrive with no information whatsoever. So there's no, oh, I know why you like that. Or, you know, if my daughter says, oh, I'd love a cheese and onion pasty, I'll go, yeah, I ate nothing but them when I was pregnant with you. But we don't have any of that. And people think, well, that's good then. You've just got, and it's not, because we've got it in there. We just can't bring it out. We can't recall it, but it's there.
Yeah.
And to think that just adopting in the very act is going to heal that. I mean, I know this is going to, I've got a friend who's an adoptee in the UK at the moment. And he's gone for special guardianship, and the children that they're caring for see their grandparents. And they haven't had their names changed. So they've got the best of both worlds, because they're living in a house where they're very much loved and they're being brought up beautifully, but they still have their names and they still have connections to their birth parents, and they're not trying to be somebody that they're not. They're not trying to fit in with, you know, it's a kinship care as well. So, you know, for me, it ticks every single box. But that's to me, that's the way forward. I can't see adoption as being something that is sustainable in the long term, because as we acknowledge more and more the trauma that is there, because it will come out more and more, then people are going to have to acknowledge that actually taking a child, altering their birth certificate, erasing that part of them as if it never existed, is only to the detriment of the child. And the best thing that you can do is be open and acknowledge it, and acknowledge it as part of who they are, because it is part of who they are. It is part of their identity. And if you remove that, you just get very troubled teenagers. And you know, there's a reason why adoptees are 4 times more likely to die by suicide. You know, there's a reason for that. And that needs to be acknowledged.
Vic, thank you so much for your time. And, I think you've raised lots of really interesting points, and you've been so generous with your own story as well, which I think will probably really help a lot. Well, it will help a lot of people, whether they empathise with that, whether it shadows their own story, or whether they're parents who are looking to support their own children, their adoptive children, through that. So thank you so much for your time. And
no worries. And yourself. If anybody wants to reach out, I get very shouty when people tell me that I'm wrong for my lived experience. But yeah, if people want to listen, then I'm normally very, very receptive. And I can make it go both ways. Do you know what I mean? Like I started out saying, I do believe that some children, ultimately, adoption is the only way that they're going to get looked after. But I would prefer it if it could be done as legal guardianship. But I don't want those children to be left without a loving home, because I think that's the very least every child deserves.
Yeah.
But anyway.
That's a good summary of where you stand, isn't it, really? Well, thank you so much, and you look after yourself.
Yeah, you too. Thank you very much.